This is tape two of Theodore Kennedy interview. We were talking about the sirens. This is tape two of Theodore Kennedy interview. We were talking about the sirens going off outside your classroom.
Yeah. That if they have to go off on the first day of the month, for heaven's sake, shoot them at 12:30 when the classes are changing. Mm-hmm. Or if they have to go at 12 o'clock, then have it the first Saturday of the month. Mm-hmm. And but I'm pretty testy in the letter. And we got a reply from Fortin, soothing somewhat, and saying they have to be there for storm warnings, tornado warnings, and but also directing the whoever is responsible hereafter to blow them at 12:30. Mm-hmm. So that's my single contribution to Michigan State.
Oh, I think there's probably more than that. The within the department or university college, did you have any administrative duties, or were your
mainly work full time and academic
in teaching?
Advising? Yeah,
I see.
In the department committees, I served on, I think, about every committee except scheduling and social, mm-hmm. One time or another. The interesting interval though was when they built Case Hall, and decided to, the province had seen all the kids running around, and that'll be time and energy, all these people wasted. So they thought, maybe, why not put classes in the dormitories where they don't have to walk around to them? So about a half a dozen of us from the University College were signed over to Case Hall, where we had our offices, and they arranged classrooms for us to meet in. And that was in, I believe, fall term. It was in winter term, winter and spring term, I believe, 61. Bessie Hall just opened, so I added one term here in Bessie, and then I went over to Case Hall. And I had an office on the fifth floor of the girls' wing. And the idea of men and women in the same dormitory, although one wing was, the north wing was for women, south wing was for men, and the only shared accommodation were the recreation room, the dining hall, mm-hmm. and so on. And that was still a pretty shocking idea in 1960. For the two terms we were there, there was just Case Hall, nothing else over that area except the fire station. It was like having a small college right on a large university campus. I mean, just terrific. We had a separate schedule. We had our classes started from 8 to 8:50, and then the next class was 8:55, and then there would be a 20-minute break. I think of how it worked out. And it was just wonderful, because we could teach a class and then go into the coffee area. And if the student wanted to, they'd come along with us, and we'd sit around and shoot the breeze there after class. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to see us, all they had to do was take the elevator up to our office. And we had a degree of isolation and more privacy in a way. We had offices connected by shower. These were residential rooms, intended mm-hmm. to be. Mm-hmm. And on a hot summer day, the time or two, we'd strip down and take a shower. So we ate our lunches in the cafeteria with the students, often with them, and as I say, it was like, and this was just Case Hall students, mm-hmm. and so again, as I say, it was like being in a small college, having it there. Well, the next fall, a Wilson Hall opened, and they intermingled the students. They had classes in Wilson, too, but the Wilson students would take classes in Case and vice versa, and that ended it. And then it was just like being here only. And a year after that, they opened a Wonders Hall. So then it simply became a large university, just a segment of it.
So the residential concept was good at first, but then
it certainly
expanded.
Was, yeah. But you see, you have to have enough association with the students to get to know them. And if you only see them 1 hour a week, or 3 hours a week, or it's not going to happen.
What would you say in terms of your own classroom and your teaching over your career, what did you find to be most gratifying about teaching?
Well, not as much as I would have expected before I became a teacher. See, Wabash College is a very small school. When I was there, its enrollment was about 400 men. It's now about 800 men, so it's doubled. But I expected more contact, out-of-classroom contact with students, which doesn't happen here very much. Now, this may be a factor of my own personality, because I know Steve Elliston, a colleague, is always having students to see, around to see him. He's a delightful fellow and obviously made them feel welcome. He also has an amazing memory for student names, which I didn't. I always tried to learn my students by sight, by name, and usually succeeded to get them all by the end of the term. There were always a few that took longer than most. But then next term comes, it's just like erasing the blackboard. But Steve, he can see a student he had in class a year or two before and he remembers his name. So he's greater than in that way. But
I always like the question they ask you, do you remember me? And the answer is, oh, of course I remember you.
Well, I often did remember them by face.
By face,
I suppose the greatest gratification is having a contact with a student who's been in your class a year or two or three before. I'm still in touch with a few, not many, two or three, I suppose, former students.
Did some of the administrative problems that you encountered, yeah, you were the official historian of the department, is that right?
Yeah, I guess for a while, yeah.
When was the transition made to American Thought and Language?
That happened, I can't be positive on the date, but about 1959. Let's back up and catch up. As I say, I think Mr. Bagwell ran for Auditor General in 1956. And 2 years later, he ran for governor and ran a pretty good race against Men and Williams. And he gave him a good race. And so good, in fact, that Williams left after in 1960. Well, he had got a job in Washington from Kennedy. And his lieutenant governor, Swainson, ran in 60. And Paul again ran for governor and didn't win. Well, between 1958, I think after the, about 1959, he was ousted as head of the department, chairman, and they gave him an assignment on the campus, because you don't fire the possible future governor. And then after the 1960 race, or maybe even before, I think he left the campus. he made a lot of money very quickly, and lost most of it.
Oh.
And then died rather suddenly of a cerebral hemorrhage. And his wife, a lovely lady, and very attractive, died 2 weeks later. Same thing.
Wow.
Just amazing.
And he wasn't that old.
No, I wasn't terribly old. So, anyway, to get back to your question, I believe Ed Blackman, who has been in the humanities department, the dean picked him as our new chairman, succeeding Bagwell. And he came in with a new course, which is to do away with speech, public speaking training, which was fine with me. Even though my training had all been in the field of speech, or that is a major in it, because freshmen don't have very much to say. it's just a waste of money. They'll do so much better and they'll learn so much more if they're even a year older, a year or two older. Because by that time, they have a little more confidence, a good deal more confidence, and they know the practical value of it and so on. But at any rate, and he proposed this course where we, in a sense, take American intellectual history as the framework for our composition course. And that was a challenge. And it was very stimulating. Most of the speech majors left the department. Not all, but most of those. So it became a very exciting course. And I was kind of involved in the shaping of the curriculum when it was being drafted. Had a very, very fine committee. I was more of the observer than anything else, but the practical man. But I have to tell of something that made the course for me more than anything else. In the 1960s, maybe early 70s, I forgot now just when, I was asked to be a lecturer at a conference for new beginning college teachers, and it was a program being run out of the University of Iowa. That was a 2-week conference, at least initially. And so I was given a lecturing assignment. And I don't know, I guess, how to be a good teacher, I guess, is the point of it. So I told them about the problem I faced in that, and when this new course is being set up. Start out, we're going to study Puritanism. Puritanism. Here are these young, healthy animals in the late 20th century, and you're going to have to teach them about 16th century theology, for God's sake. You know? And I thought to myself, how in the world am I going to... I didn't so much, I was concerned about offending people because, you know, my knowledge is pretty skimpy to begin with. As I am, here we have all these students come up, they're graduates of these parochial schools, the Catholic parochial schools, and then we have youngsters from the Dutch Reformed churches in Western Michigan who probably know more about Calvin than I do, and everything in between. How in the world am I going to avoid offending somebody? I just see myself trying to walk a high wire for this time. And then a thought hit me. Instead of worrying about offending this group or that group or the other group, why don't I offend them all? And so I figured out, we had a little preliminary unit before we got into Puritanism. But about the end of the second week, on a Friday, because I wanted them to stew over the weekend, I came in and pointed out to them that being a tax-supported school, it'd be very wrong for me to try to impose any religious views or opinions on them. And that's not my intention at all. However, We do, in order to understand our society today, we have to look at the Puritans because they had so much influence on the way we live today. In order to understand the way they lived and thought, we have to understand their theology, their religious beliefs. And to understand that, we need to appreciate, we need to know the views of a man named John Calvin, Jean Calvin, or whatever. And so it's only fair for me to warn you that when I have explained to you the truth about the relation of God and man as set forth by John Calvin, you will probably be compelled by the sheer force of his logic to give up whatever other mistaken religious beliefs you have heretofore held. And you do it all with a straight face, which is the hardest part. See? I tell you, yeah, it's like looking at a room full of half dollars open like this. And so I go through the, you know, the theology, the total depravity of man and the omnipotence of God and all that. And they're sitting there like they're hypnotized, taking this in. And then I always ask for questions. And the questions always came. And they would, I explained to these young teachers that they would ask 20th century questions, and I'd give them 16th century answers. Mm-hmm. And it was a very frustrating time for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so that was, of course, the smarter ones smelled a rat, a big rat, and the others would stew about it and didn't know where they were or what they were. So from then on, I just assumed they were all Puritans. You know, that way.
But if you brought Puritans to life in the classroom, that was at least that, to get him to think. That seemed to be
an
interesting technique.
A couple of weeks later, then I kind of gradually slid into deism, pointing out some of the shortcomings of Paul, Calvinism, and here, great pitch of deism. Mm-hmm. And they're thinking, oh, he's not really a Puritan, he's a deist.
At least for the third week of the course.
Yeah, right? And at that time, we also, I think, covered transcendentalism in the first term. And of course, you get into that same thing again. Mm-hmm. One spring, I don't know why, but I got to thinking about these 20th century writers we're getting into, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Sinclair Lewis and a whole bunch, and the non-Orthodox Christian among them, really. And it was Holy Week, and there was Passover, and there was Good Friday, and there was all this. And I mentioned this to one of my classes. Maybe they did both of them. These were, again, these big 200-student classes. And I said, on Friday, while it isn't necessary that we give the devil equal time, it seems reasonable that we give him some time. So on Friday, you don't have to come to class if you don't want to, or you can bring your religious advisor if you want to, but I'm going to give a lecture on 20th century atheism. And I did. And it was all right. It wasn't the best, most successful it could have been, should have been. But at the end of the term that year, I was asking them for questions about the final exam. And one student, a little red-cheeked kid from the western part of the state, he said, Mr. Kennedy, last fall you had us believing you were a Puritan, and then you had us believing you were a deist, then this winter you convinced us you were a transcendentalist, then you turn around and give us a lecture on atheism. Now, would you tell us what is your religious position or belief? And I thought, oh my God, I'm caught. I said, well, you may ask. and I will answer. I am a hypocrite. He was like, they had a great time. I have to mention one other class. Teachers always tell you about the great success. But It was, I don't remember which year, it was the middle of the 60s, about 64, maybe a little bit later, when Michigan State had put Gordon Sabine in charge of recruitment, former dean of cognitive communication. He did a terrific job. And we had, I think, 135 merit scholars in the freshman class, three times as many as Harvard. Mm-hmm. And I was given an honors class that met at night, two nights a week, in the seminar room here in Bessie. And this was the most terrific teaching experience of all my years of teaching. I don't think I ever worked as hard, had such an intense class. It took intense effort, because these kids were sharp. And if you ask a question, you had to listen to what they were saying carefully and analyze it, and at the same time be anticipating your next question, which usually is easy, but not so easy with these kids. Well, I used the same gimmicks with them I did with others, only they began laughing much quicker. And we met in that class, in that classroom, two nights a week. And long toward the end of the term, I had a cohort at my house one night. We met over there. There were 25 students in that class. 23 of them were back the next term, and one of those had left to go home and get married, a girl. And I don't remember who the other dropout was. And I think there were 23 A's in the class. And at that point, we had the 4.5, the A-plus grade, and I think at least a half a dozen of them got that. Mm-hmm. It was so delightful to know. And we got along just great. And so I had them for two terms. Well, the next spring term, it was no longer going to be a night class. And I thought, well, they ought to have the experience of somebody else anyway in teaching. So I told them I really didn't want them to come in my class the next term. They should have somebody else. And I went down the list, and when I got to my class, I thought, well, some ass teaches that, you know. And that happened. Two members of that class got married. They came back and took independent study with me one term, and then later got married, and later after that got divorced, unfortunately. And I'm still in touch with the girl by email. But that was a marvelous time. But God, it was hard work. It was really demanding.
When did you retire?
1984. Mm-hmm. I came back the next fall, that fall, taught one class that fall and the next fall.
What, since you've been retired, how have you been spending your time?
Not very efficiently. I've written, I've gotten more things published since I retired than afterward, which is no coincidence. The same thing is true, I'm sure, of Marilyn Culpepper. She's published a couple of books, you know, very prolific. You just don't have time when you're doing, if you're a conscientious teacher, Dave Anderson has no children. So his, Mert Babcock, another prolific colleague, I think he had one son who was pretty much grown. And these are men who just can devote great chunks of time available. Most of my colleagues, I think, just don't have that. And also maybe they get more fatigued from teaching. Mm-hmm. I do an awful lot of reading. I'm a great reader. I read probably 30 to 50 books a year. Mm-hmm. I think that's... And I'm not a very fast reader either, so it takes me more time to get through. Mm-hmm.
What have you read most recently?
I just finished reading a book called A Soldier for Napoleon, mm-hmm. of all things. A Bavarian soldier, not really a very good book, but the interesting part were his letters home. He was involved in the just 1812 and 1813, including the invasion of Moscow or Russia. He didn't. Yeah, his unit didn't go very far into Russia, but they were there, and their outfit dissolved too, along with the rest of Napoleon's army. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, that was a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. He took nearly a half million men, and I'd say 80% of them didn't come back. Mm-hmm. Wow. So it was. Oh, I read. I have my interests everywhere. I have a biography of Frederick II and a biography of Alistair Cook waiting. I prefer, my preference are history and biography, mm-hmm. mostly. My hobby is, I was standing in Windsor Castle, I believe it was, looking at Queen Mary's dollhouse. And good friends of ours, had a very late baby, a little girl, and she was about 8. And I thought, by golly, her parents have a beautiful home. I'm going to make a miniature of their home, which was kind of stupid, because if you make it 1 inch to the foot, it turned out to be a heck of a big house. You know, the thing would cover this end of the table, uh-huh. practically. But at any rate, it was quite a project, and made that for their daughter. And my wife said, why don't you make one for your own granddaughter? So I decided to make her a miniature of our house on Beach Street. And she is now about 25 or 6 years old, and I've almost got the house finished. She had it for a couple of years when she was the right age. Mm-hmm. Then they moved and I brought it home to do more work on it.
Just in time for her daughter.
Well, she's gonna just gotten engaged, so maybe we're out that way. I used to enjoy that so much. I'd just go down to the basement, go to work, and just time and just evaporate. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm not a very skilled or very fast workman, so, and I haven't done much work on it in the past year or two. So,
in looking back at your career, what would you say are some of your most vivid recollections? You stayed here your whole career, pretty much after you came.
Yes, I did, except for these intervals in Washington. Uh-huh. Well, I don't know. I don't think I would. I'd do it again. I remember looking at when I was a senior in college, thinking about my future, and I looked at what seemed to me the role, the nature of the work of the Wabash faculty, and seemed to me a pretty nice life. Well, I was right. It is a nice life. You don't get dirt on your fingernails teaching. And it certainly beats farming by 80 miles. But you just don't accomplish as much as you feel like you should. At least I don't feel I did. You never know. You just never know. I was in a doctor's office a month or so back, and just leaving, a man spoke up to me, addressed me, and he's a former student. And he's now on the law faculty here at Michigan State. So but a teacher is writing in water, really. And I think the best you could do is probably to contribute to the experience, along with other teachers, other things. But
sounds like you've had an impact on those students.
Well, some, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose. I think, I hope that some of them learned or came to understand that learning can be fun. I mentioned Heseltine at Wisconsin, whose lectures were so enjoyable. In fact, I plagiarized from him frequently whenever I could. But at one time, my last class I had with him was in summer school, and a book had just come out about the administrative, the governmental operations and behind the Iron Curtain. I think the title of the book was something like the bureaucrat and, oh, I can't think of the flunky, the guy who did the routine work. And he had a very hospital voice, all like this. And he said, our course is organized according to modern socialistic principles. We have a bureaucrat who's in charge of things. Then we have the clerk who does a humdrum routine work. Mr. Brown, my graduate assistant, is the bureaucrat. I am the clerk. And I got thinking, bureaucrat, $55 a month. They paid me the grad assistant. I blurted out, who gets paid the most? The shock that I fell a summer school graduate. And
what's this?
I repeated it.
Well, compensation is based on socialistic principle. From each according to needs, from each according to its abilities. I've screwed it up. Yeah. He had it right. And everyone roared, and he smiled at me all the rest of the period. From each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs.
And a time or two when I was introducing my readers, I used a version.